just kind of nice to have a change of scenery.
Yeah.
Like, regardless,
it's like you're on a vacation, right? You go into another room and transport to a whole different location.
Exactly. It's a whole new world in here.
Welcome to This Week in Pubathon, Week 8, A Whole New World. There's a lot going on this week. A lot of different side conversations. One of them we even pull into the After Dark. Yeah, a new feature of This Week in Pubathon, the After Dark. You'll have to tune into that to see what that's about. But in this episode, we'll go on some tangents about best ways to look at Olympia oyster genetic diversity and tools going forward with that. Learn about some new ways to visualize gene expression analysis in a clustering format without annotation, and finally go deep into some of Laura's new results with her gene expression analysis. So enjoy.
My pipeline for SNP calling just finished on all of my samples just overnight. Cool. So that's awesome. Or I think it did. And then I do have some preliminary results to discuss today. So I'm just going to be generous and give myself a 10 this week.
All right. What a week.
Great.
All right. Aiden, you had two from last week. Get new transcriptome all the way through GoMu and analyze DEGs of HMAT.
I would say in terms of getting the new CREB transcriptome, I started on that. I'm currently getting it, building those Callisto indices right now. And for the analyzing of the DEGs, I did kind of like a pretty cursory analysis, but I think I'd like to dive in a little more detail. Yeah, everything's running pretty smoothly. No real hiccups or problems to report.
Sam had two, was a review OSF and continue to read through the manuscript.
I addressed some things and started to look through OSF. So maybe I'll bump score up to 5.
All right.
This week.
Wow, Stephen was very ambitious. He had the most goals of anybody from last week.
I think energy is great, though, because it could really be a whole range of actual things.
Yeah, I had some internal energy that never kind of got to fruition on the oyster paper. But there's a reason for that. This was a very tough week. I wrote one of the best paragraphs ever in the Gooduck paper, and then they changed the results section on me the next day. So it was all pointless. I was so frustrated the rest of the week. I just haven't had the motivation to write anymore. I mean, I went deep into some new theories on methylation, and they said, "Sorry, we showed you the wrong results." So I'm just going to take a couple weeks to recover from that. Follow up with Faze. I think I'm cool. I think I've already followed up with Faze. I don't know if I'm pretty sure I can double check about the author list. I'm sure I've did that years ago, but I'll do it again with the paper. And we did make some progress on the Hawaii thing, and that was just by chance, because Maria contacted us about it. And so we even jumped a little higher on that in terms of the methods and getting her a link and getting her engaged in putting in the experimental design on that paper. I think I'd give myself a 7 this week. All right. Grace, it looks like you had 2. Start writing more in the discussion after reading through some of the literature I've downloaded. And this is an interesting kind of slant on a goal to put maybe in the goal, but it says maybe play around more with improving figures 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a clause of a sentence.
I add
a little half of a sentence to something. And then I found a couple more papers I think work really well with the discussion. And then the second goal is kind of, I didn't do anything, but that's okay. Okay. It's like a maybe. So I think I'll give myself an 8.
Okay.
And then I'll keep my goals for next week.
All right, and then Catherine had write intro paragraph about OLEs and update method on most recent analyses.
I wrote 3 paragraphs.
Three?
I wrote 3.
Oh my God.
It turns out all I need to get me to work on this is have a major grant due today and then procrastinate on the Ole paper. But yeah, no, I wrote the Ole paragraph, but also wrote some about, you know, why this question matters and a little bit about sort of like plasticity, adaptation, environment. So yeah, I'm pretty proud of myself. Did not do the methods part, so I will transfer that to next week. I'm gonna give myself a 10.
All right.
Yeah.
Job.
A lot of writing this week.
And yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
All right. How about you, Mac?
My goals were carried over. It was about mapping to the new version of the Jagus genome, which I did, which also brought up something new. Just is that we got a new cluster and our old cluster died, and I had to transfer the data back over the raw reads from NextSeq. And now they live on Gannett on my little folder. Is there an archive place to put these reads in addition to where they live on Gannett?
I think Sam archives Gannett if you're talking about safety, but.
Yeah, I'm just talking about safety.
Okay.
I mean, I still had the reads on a head node, but I just got rid of everything and just transferred them back over from Gannett because it was kind of, I don't know.
Did you MD5 them?
No.
Okay, that's good enough.
That's good. Yeah. Where are they on Gannett? I mean,
bar users, Charlie, I don't know, wherever I live. I'd have to look back at my rsync.
that location is not backed up anywhere.
Okay.
But if I put them in my directory, they'd be backed up, right, Sam?
Yeah, they need to be in one of the web folders.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll rsync them to one of my directories, and then they'll be backed up.
Okay.
Or, I mean, we could put it at Nightingales would be the proper place to put it, right, Sam? Is Nightingales backed up?
Yes, to multiple places.
Okay. So that's probably the best place to put it for organizational purposes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what are these?
Well, raw sequence reads from the single cell data.
Ah.
Okay. From single cell RNA-seq.
Yeah, gotcha.
That's like two NextSeq lanes.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, all that aside, it went pretty well. Cell Ranger worked with the new GTF. I added the long non-coding RNAs. My mapping went up to 85% instead of 70 with the new genome, which still feels crazy. But, you know, I ran it through Monocle, just the downstream, and most of the genes that were coming up before were coming up again. So it's not surprising, but I feel better about the workflow.
And your number is?
I don't know. I'm so skippy. Give me half. No, half the points. What is it? 10 out of 10?
Yeah.
So going biggest? Okay, I'll take 5.
All right. So now let's go. We go back the other direction and see what folks are up to, and maybe even kind of show us some stuff too if we're still thinking about definitely figures or analysis and or the such. All right, so we'll go back, starting with, we'll let Max start there. What's the next set of goals, next steps in the process, I guess?
For next week, I'm going to meet with Lauren on Monday. She's the genome science person that helps me with Monocle and everything, and I'm going to ask her my questions and methods just to go over some of the comments I have in my doc. And then I want to go through all the kind of my whole Monocle workflow in R, just to look at everything remapped and see if all the patterns look the same. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's like over clustering going on when I put all of the cells in there. So I don't know. Talking with her always kind of helps figure that stuff out.
Okay. And then I'll hopefully get the Roslyn gene list that corresponds to those LOAP numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And get the corresponding sea urchin clusters, quote unquote, linked or joined to that, right?
Yeah.
Is that still helpful?
Yep. And it just kind of to add to that real quick, that table that we were looking at yesterday on NCBI, because it doesn't, it's only has the protein coding. I went back to the gene FASTA, and because the FASTA line, the little carrot line or whatever the heck you call it, has the gene ID and whether or not it's a non-coding RNA or an mRNA. So I'm going to filter that to use that as my little two-column table of loc and ID, because then it'll just have non-coding RNAs, because otherwise that table just said protein coding.
Oh, okay.
And that was missing some IDs.
Right. And hopefully that aligns directly to the GTF that you used.
Yes.
All right. And that same FASTA file will be the exact same FASTA file I'll use to do sequence homology with sea urchin so that we can cross-link tables.
Yep.
Okay. And that's on NCBI?
Yep.
Okay.
And I use the RefSeq.
RefSeq. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Catherine, it's you. What's up? What's on this week's agenda?
I will update methods on the analyses that aren't that recent. They were a few weeks ago, but on the ones I did, maybe clean up my results a little bit. I think they might be kind of, no, I should probably actually, I'll work on the discussion. Yeah, I'll say write at least a paragraph in the discussion.
All right, that reminds me. I talked to Kevin Johnson yesterday. So I don't know if y'all have heard, but they're going to, Nature Conservancy down there is going to like do a whole new Ola genome with Dovetail Genomics. And, you know, realistically, it'll probably be a year before it's out. That made me have to go back. He was asking about our data and talking about, you were talking about old stuff. The PacBio, we were looking at the PacBio files for what we're using, the Ola genome, and that's from 2013. So I might be up there with one of the oldest data sets for a paper.
The PacBio is 24. I thought there was more sequencing done like later.
Could have been.
Yeah.
I mean, all the Ola genome is a short reads in PacBio put to mashed together.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely remember like 2013, some was done, and that's when BGI was like, sorry, we can't put this together for you. And then.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Was BGI did some? Did BGI do some of that Ola stuff?
Yeah, I think they did at least most that's of right. the short read stuff. Yeah, and I thought it was like 2015 or something. Some more.
That's probably right. Because I think we did the PacBio. I think we used the PacBio. Isn't the PacBio mentioned in the paper?
Yeah.
Okay. So we did merge the two. We did merge that. So you're probably right. The short read stuff came after the 2013. But we also had a very interesting conversation about just like what we've had here and just getting his opinion about genotype. And well, not maybe here, maybe it was Science Hour or something about. If we want to call SNPs, if we want to do genetic analyses, do we do arrays or what? And I was like, I can't find arrays. And he came up because Nature Conservancy wants to do arrays to do like Ola populations to generate them. And I was like, isn't that kind of old technology? And, you know, he was kind of in the same general ideas. Like, why wouldn't you just do whole genome resequencing with the cost being down? I don't know. What is your, I don't think you've been part of these conversations before, Catherine. What do you think about that if you were going to be worried about only genetic diversity and conservation aquaculture, and you were a hatchery down in California or anywhere, what's the best approach?
I mean, I don't think you need. I personally don't think just like, I mean, maybe whole genome resequencing would be okay, and maybe it would be cost efficient, but I don't think RAD is really the way to go, just because it's so variable. To get the same sites each time, but then there's, I forget what it's called, something RAD, where you are targeting specific SNPs that you've previously identified.
Yeah.
I think whatever that flavor of RAD is would be the way to go. Cause then you could like look at our, like the GBS data I have, the GBS data you guys have, and like I have like SNPs that show signs of adaptation, and I have SNPs that like show high polymorphism, and so you can target those, probably be able to do a lot more individuals and be confident that you're like keeping those variants like across all individuals.
Yeah,
what is that called? It's like targeted RAD seq. Yeah, so that, I mean, that's what I think would be good.
Yeah, I guess that was the other thing we talked about. I mean, as long as you knew what you're, if you had targets, if a priori that were good enough, that would make sense, definitely from a cost effectiveness standpoint.
Yeah. But I mean, I think like my data has those targets. And so I actually had this conversation with Rick, a few years ago, right before I started my postdoc, because he was like, yeah, you know, they're really interested in Puget Sound and like doing a bunch of RADseq and getting population structure. And I was like, I mean, you could do that, but like, I have all the SNPs you need to like characterize what population structure and even probably relatedness is. It just seems silly to like do that all again, do the analysis all again, get a different set of SNPs that would tell you the same thing. Yeah.
So what I've kind of been paying attention to, what are they? What is Rick and Crystal doing with that? I mean, I don't know, Mac, you might know the most.
Yeah, I have the data and it was RAD and it was the-
So they didn't listen to Catherine. Okay.
Well, I think the looking into it, I know he asked Krista, like, how do you design a rapture? Because that, rapture, you know, in order to do a targeted capture, there's upfront work to that.
Okay.
And I think part of it was we could design this rapture, we could go to a company, we could get these markers, or we could just run 6 plates of RAD, which actually is pretty easy.
Okay. Yeah.
The problem was that, you know, they ran it with the fish enzyme and there aren't as many cut sites. So then it became a whole, how do you troubleshoot this long fragment? What's wrong with this mollusk DNA? Like, you just have long pieces of DNA because you don't have that many cut sites.
So
there's SBF data for 3 populations, hatchery and wild.
But can't you also use that? I mean, what's the Sean?
A totally different enzyme than Catherine's data. So it becomes useful.
Like, not comparable at all. Yeah, no, this, I was talking to him about it and yeah, he was just like, well, they just kind of want to like, we'll just make RAD labs. Like, so I was like, I mean, yeah, that's easy to write a grant for and people know how to do it and that's fine, but it seemed kind of
But isn't there a sequence, I forget the name of it, GT-seq or something, where you could, if you had your targets, like from Catherine's, you could design primers and then run those in next-gen sequencing. Is that GT-seq? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, GT-seq. And so if you have a great panel of SNPs where you know you have diversity from the populations you're looking for, like that's what they do with all the salmon.
Yeah.
Because you have a 300 SNP panel, or maybe you just want SIBSHIP, so you do a 96 SNP panel. So if you know those informative SNPs, then yeah, you design a panel and you use it forever. That to me, that's way more cost effective than arrays. And who's going to have those forever? They're going to die.
Yeah.
It's just so silly.
Yeah. Yeah, the GT-seq always seemed, if you knew your target, like Catherine says she does with Goalie.
Super easy.
Yeah.
Put a ton of samples on a MySeq lane.
Yeah. I mean, it probably takes some development up front, but once you have it, I mean.
You can run thousands of samples.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that kind of circles back to our lab. And if we were to do anything with any species, that would probably be to make the most sense.
That's like the bummer of having Catherine's data and Rick's data is that it's like, wow, it'd be great to use all the OLE data to make this informative GT-seq panel, but everybody's data is covering different subsets of the genome.
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be a total shot in the dark, but if there's like linkage between the stuff they picked out, because I assume they were looking at like hatchery distinct from wild populations, is that the idea? Yeah, like if you found some SNPs that are distinct in hatchery populations and they just happen to be like 200 base pairs away from a SNP that I have or something, then you might be able to like compare it that way, but it would probably be a bit of a shot in the dark. But for the stuff that Kevin's talking about for like California, I assume, like I have like a lot of California data, and so
he knows about all your stuff because they were talking, somebody wanted to like redo what you did or what was doing, and Kevin was like, no, I mean, she's got all this information, you're wasting your time, he might do it. I mean, it's just basically, you know, Nature Conservancy wants to go down that path, and I don't know if he's going to try to talk him out of it or not, but
Well, if you talk to him again, or tell him that, I'd be happy to chat with him more.
Okay.
Because I would love for people to use like all the stuff I did. That's why I did it. And yeah, I feel like it's sometimes people get stuck in a
But if, for example, they went with an array, though, they would be using your data because you have to pick what SNPs you want to look at. I mean, you have to print the array. Word. I just can't even imagine going through that process.
Yeah, GTSeq sounds a lot more. Then you just, you know, buy a MySeq or something if you have funds that you need to use or.
Yeah, exactly. Because it could do so much more. That's a good point. All right. I don't know how we got down that hole. Where were we? Catherine was talking about this week's stuff, right? All right. So then we go up to Grace, I think.
I think so. Yeah. I would like to write more discussion. And I think I'll just stick with that.
Oh, Steven, I'm so traumatized by the GUIDUC paper. I think I'm going to have to let that one go for a while. Just kind of sit with that and focus more of my time on the OYSTER paper, OYSTER. But if y'all change the results when I start writing, I'm going to be very sad. So my energy this week will be in the OYSTER paper, the OLLI paper. All right. How about you, Sam?
Now that I've recovered from that mistake that sent me behind last week and finished with the new crab transcriptome assembly, I will 100% finish all the goals of reviewing all the OSF README files, make sure they're accurate, and reviewing files that are in the OSF repo, make sure that we know what the heck they are and whether or not they're actually useful, as well as reading through the paper. So
I've done that. All right, how about you, Aiden?
Well, I think I'll keep the first goal of getting the crab transcriptome all the way through GoMu. Actually, I think I'll keep both goals and also add in rewrite the method section.
Okay. So does that make sense? You know, we're talking about the WGCNA it doesn't necessarily be WGCNA, and I don't remember who has most experience with this, but just some type of pattern analysis that's irrespective of annotations that you can leverage over time. You know, Shelley's got a paper on that. Again, that's proteins, but it might be some of the same software. And, you know, Emma did it with proteins too. But the whole idea of over time, what kind of clusters do you have? So to me, it would be very interesting within one sample. You know, you should get to a point where you have like maybe 8 clusters. Maybe cluster one is down, down, up. Cluster two is down, up, down. Maybe cluster three is up, up, down. Conceptually, does that make sense?
I mean, I think I need to learn about how WGCNA works a little more. But yeah, conceptually, that makes sense.
So but outside of the weeds of the software, that's where you kind of want to be, is to being able to look at patterns over time. I don't know what page. Let me see if I pull it up. Because I don't necessarily know that's the best software to do it with. Have you used anything like that before, Catherine? Do you know what I'm talking about?
WGCNA?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I use that for my dissertation. That stuff's not published yet, but I do have some code for it that I can send if that would be helpful.
Yeah, that'd be really great.
Yeah. It was written in the throes of last minute dissertation writing, so I can't promise it's like my most annotated code, but it should work. Yeah, I'll make a note. It probably won't be until Monday, but I might be able to get to it today. And you have like phenotype data for these guys, or?
I mean, I believe there's, I mean, I'm not really examining the phenotype data that much,
mm-hmm.
But it does exist. Grace, I think you took some pretty detailed notes on phenotype.
And the goal is you've got these temporal samples through time at different temperatures and, you know, 3 time points. And so what the idea is looking in my mind, this is a good kind of representation. I don't know, this is probably done with another software, but, you know, this is different clusters of protein expression to see how many you get. And then once you get those, you know, you can pull out what genes are in what clusters, and it would be interesting to see what they are in terms of functionality after the fact or how they go across samples. So for example, we're going to be interested to see, you know, what I mean, it is part, to me, it's a little bit of still data. It's a little bit in the discovery phase, you know, but trying to see, are there things that go up over time, down over time, change over time? Is there a network of genes associated with this? And then comparing samples after the fact. So Catherine, when you used it, what was your application of WGCNA?
Yeah, so I actually think I have a different R package that would do better what you're describing, okay. Stephen. But what I was looking at was like associations between the treatment and time. And I had like their wet weight, for example. But if you are just kind of interested in gene expression patterns through time and yeah. finding like clusters of genes that change, there's something called DEG report that okay. I've been playing with lately. I'll add it in the chat. But it's nice because it integrates easily with the output of DE-seq, which I assume okay. is what you're using. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And so then it like makes these nice plots of like through time. And then if you have different groups, it'll plot like the two groups and what those genes are doing through time. So yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah. That sounds exactly more appropriate. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, my computer is being very slow. Okay. Yeah, I'll send you in the chat. So yeah, I think this would be better. And okay. also WGCNA is kind of like a pain to use. It just has like many, many, many parameters and a lot of like looking at things to decide arbitrary cutoffs. And if this is just like early data exploration and you don't have like some continuous traits that you're looking at, I feel like that would for now be more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah, no, that sounds great.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'll check this out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It says you could filter them, make groups of genes using expression, but you could filter and just throw it in the DEGs. But my suggestion would be not to filter and just look at everything because basically you don't have that many DEGs when it comes down to it.
Yeah. It does get mad if you have more than like 3,000 genes. Yeah, it'll yell at you, and then if it's a lot, it can take a really long time. Yeah.
But yeah,
it'll still work just fine despite all the yelling.
I mean, I think I tried it once with over 5,000 and it just like after 15 minutes it still hadn't spit anything out, and so I was like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, how many hamadenium genes are you working with now?
Well, I have just 4 DEGs.
No reason to run it on 4 DEGs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In that case, then, yeah, if you had 1,000 or something, a few thousand.
And should I just do this for like since I'm looking at like the DEC output, like I'm looking at the specific pairwise comparisons where I'm looking at like one sample group versus another rather than putting all of my data in there?
I think it needs to. You can't just look at one individual. Is that what you're asking?
Oh, no. I have like, what, 5 different like treatment groups
mm-hmm.
that would be interesting to look at. But each pairwise comparison that I've put through so far is like just 2 of those groups, which is like 6 samples total. So basically, I should just put in those 2 groups versus everything.
Yeah, I mean, you could put in everything. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it will still color all 6 groups and you might see something kind of interesting. It just probably gets a little messy at that point with that many groups. But if you have, like 2 groups you're particularly interested in, that might be cleaner. I mean, yeah, I always think you could try it. And then if it's, saying like, this is way too many, I can't do it. If it looks messy, then just filter some more.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I also just added a little tutorial that sort of shows you more about plotting.
Yeah. I'm trying to get an example of what they look like. Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be very interesting to look at from a discovery point of view, to have every point. And yeah, I like that. Nice find.
Yeah, that was a good one.
All right, I got that. And then I think it's just Laura.
Yep. So I have a ton of slides. I'll try to make it really quick. Yeah, if anyone needs to leave, please feel free. All right, let's see. All right, you guys seeing this? Okay, so yeah, so I'm gonna show you all some just like preliminary gene expression results from my Olympia Oyster QuantSeq project. So it's a lot, a lot of scenarios here, but basically to give you an overview of what the data came from, I have data from 3 Olympia Oyster populations, 2 generations, so adults and offspring, and then within those 2 generations, 3 life stages, so adults, offspring as larvae, offspring as about one year old. I call them juveniles, but they're not juveniles. And then there's 2 treatments. So I had exposed the adults to 2 different PCO2 treatments. And then all of the offspring were just reared in common conditions. So I'm trying to decide where to go with this data in terms of just writing up a paper if I want to focus on like what I want to focus on basically, because I have, you know, the adult PCO2 comparison, and then I have just the population comparison, which is actually pretty interesting. And if you guys have any questions, let me know.
All right, so we only see your web page that has that report thing if you're showing us something else.
Yeah, that's not what I'm trying to show. I thought I was
showing. What tissues are your samples from?
Oh, the adult was gill tissue or tinea tissue. The larvae were pooled larvae, and they're pooled by like maternal release pulse, so that's maybe family, but it could be a bit of a mix. Can you see my slides now?
Yeah.
Okay, and then the 1-year-olds were whole body. Okay, so analysis option one, like big analysis option one, is to look at differences, gene expression differences between the 2 adult PCO2 exposures. And so I, you know, there's lots of different comparisons I can do here, but I'll show you all the options, but that's like one maybe focus of the paper is how does parental PCO2 exposure influence gene expression across generations and life stages and populations. So as a quick reminder, only the adults were exposed, and they weren't exposed during like reproductive conditioning. They were exposed before that. They did have gametes at that time though, or we think they had gametes. And then the 3 populations that I'm working with are Fidalgo Bay, Debab Bay, and Oyster Bay. And they're the same batches of oysters that Catherine worked on, I worked on, my previous paper was published on, same project. Anyway, okay, so I'm not gonna go through like any of the pipeline stuff. If you guys have any questions, let me know if I can remember. I just wanna show you the results. So first off, I compared expression in the adults when they were directly exposed to ambient and high PCO2. And I collected their tissues like right out of the treatments at the very end of the 7-week treatment. And I compared it within each population. So in the Fidalgo Bay oysters, I have about 75 DEGs, Debab Bay, about 130. And then I had 1 DEG in Oyster Bay, but it's, when you dig into it, it's not an impressive difference. I would just toss that one out. So there's some differences in overall gene expression. I would expect that. So that's good. I have some phenotype data for these oysters. So I measured them before and after the PCO2 exposure. And in one of the populations, this is showing shell height by population. The white boxes are pre-PCO2 exposure. The dark boxes are the high PCO2 and the light boxes are the ambient. So basically, the main takeaway is that I did see some differences in growth rate in the 2 PCO2 exposures, but that wasn't consistent in each population. So like the Oyster Bay population, there was differences in growth rate, but the other ones weren't significant differences. In terms of biological processes that were enriched in Fidalgo Bay oysters that were exposed to different PCO2s, we had just a few different processes. I'm not going to dig into them because there's so much stuff to show you. And then a bunch more in the Debab Bay oysters. And then I compared, were there any genes that were identified as DEGs in both of those 2 populations? And I found 4, 2 of which are cytochrome P450 genes. And then one is involved, the fatty acid binding protein is involved in lipid transport. And then the thyroxine 5, never said this word before, deiodinase is related to hormone biosynthesis. So I think this is kind of cool. When I look through like all the genes, I see other things that are usual suspects like heat shock protein, more cytochrome P450, enzymes, a lot of lipid metabolism stuff. So these aren't enriched functions. These are specifically overlapping genes. But I think this is just kind of a cool, like, consistent result.
It's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm excited.
Okay, good.
Yeah, those are all cool genes. But let me get this. But in basically in Oyster Bay, you didn't really see any differential expression of genes.
No, I didn't. Yeah. Which, you know, you could tie that again to the growth rate differences. It's kind of surprising, actually. Oyster Bay was the only group that had significantly different growth rates in the high PCO2 and ambient PCO2. So basically the Oyster Bay oysters grew when they weren't exposed to high PCO2, but they didn't in the ambient PCO2.
Mm, so they maybe were less affected, and that's why they kept growing, where the other ones didn't keep growing.
So they didn't grow when they were exposed to the OA, but when they weren't exposed. So that was like, that's the only one with a significant difference. So maybe it means that they were impaired somehow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Still kind of shocking.
Yeah. Significantly different. The Fidalgo Bay does look like they got a little bigger, and there were some differences. Anyway, yeah. So that's one angle, is just like, what do Olympia oysters do upon direct exposure to, this is a pretty severe exposure. It was, pH was like 7.3. Okay. So moving on. So then I looked at their offspring. So I collected larvae as they were released from the parent, from the mother, and put a bunch of them in the freezer and did a ton of sequencing on the larvae. So I have, honestly, I don't know how many samples I had. It was like probably 80 samples or something, maybe 75. And so, you know, the question is, did the parental exposure affect the offspring gene expression as larvae when they're first released? And to me, this is the best time to look at it, because there was minimal time for selection in the larvae, and there was minimal time for like any differences in growth rates. So I was really interested in this question, and what I found was basically there was no difference. There was no effect of adult PCO2 exposure on larval gene expression. I found one DEG in the Fidalgo Bay population, and that's what I'm showing on the right. And I breezed past all these PCAs on the previous slide because there's no pattern that I could see. What I'm showing you on the left is all the populations combined, color-coded by parental PCO2 exposure.
And so can you separate those left and right groups? For the all population combined, it does look like you have two groups. They don't have anything to do with treatment. Is there any other release date or any other
thing
that separates?
That's interesting. I could, yeah. I mean, so these were like all the larvae that I could process that were released, you know, not 2 days apart, because I didn't want to get the same family twice, basically. So yeah, you're right. I could separate them by release date. Yeah. So maybe there was an effect early on, but not later on or something. Yeah, that's an idea.
Could the conditions that they were released into have changed? Like, was this over the summer and it got warmer or anything like that?
Yep, I collected them for like 6 weeks. So certainly, yeah.
Because, yeah, that's like a lot of variation on PC1. Mm-hmm. Separating out along there. So yeah, if there's some way to like a gradient coloring of date, mm-hmm. that might be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like light to dark through time.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, I will definitely do that. That's a great idea. Okay. So then I took the larvae, I grew them and set them and then grew them for a year. And then the next summer, they were planted into the field. And I'm just going to show you, I just took data from one of the locations, but they were planted in four locations. And then at the end of a 3-month field deployment, we collected them, sampled their tissue. And so I have gene expression data from those offspring that are about a year old or like 15 months old after they were deployed. I guess I'll skip ahead really quickly. It was kind of interesting. So at this one location, I saw that offspring survived. Their survival was higher if their parents had been exposed to high PCO2. And so the dark gray boxes here are, this is showing you survival, and each point is like a little deployment of a bag of oysters. So yeah, so the question was, you know, what's happening physiologically between these in these two groups if their parents had been exposed or not, that could potentially influence their survival. So this was a smaller sequencing effort. I just have four samples per population per parental treatment, and I only did Daybob Bay and Fidalgo Bay. And so these are the results. I basically see some pretty distinct clustering in the Daybob Bay population and some slightly less, but still, I think, distinct clustering in the Fidalgo Bay population. Then the big question becomes, like, who are these guys? Each point represents an oyster. And there were 15 months for them to be selected upon in the hatchery. And then during the deployment, in the year between the hatchery and the deployment, and then during the deployment, because a reminder, I just sequenced the survivors, all the ones that died didn't get sequenced. So that's why I dug into this whole like SNP analysis thing. And as I showed you guys last week, I think, so I identified SNPs. I ran them through Snipper Relate, which is an R package basically to generate PCAs. And then I also ran them through Colony. And indeed, I do see some like, so each color here represents a population and PCO2, parental PCO2 exposure. So yeah, the PCAs show me that there's very obviously some genetic differences between my groups. And then Colony identified a bunch of siblings. Oops, sorry, I'll get rid of this. So for Daybob Bay, they're all siblings, at least full or half. And then Fidalgo Bay, I have one set of full siblings and one set of half siblings. So that's, you know, that's a bummer, but that is very enlightening. And my process will be just to, like, my process up to now has just been to ignore Daybob Bay and focus on the few set of samples in Fidalgo Bay that I can that are not siblings. So basically I have three Fidalgo Bay oysters from parents who are exposed to high PCO2 and three whose parents were not. So because there's like four different combinations of samples to produce those three versus three, I did that for each four scenario, and I found five DEGs that were common. Five DEGs, so let me just clarify what we're looking at here. I looked at differential expression in these one-year-old offspring in Fidalgo Bay, and the comparison is between oysters whose parents were exposed to high PCO2 and not. And there are five differentially expressed genes that I found in all like sample combination, one of which was annotated, the other ones are not. And the biological process for this helicase looks like transcription and regulation of lipid metabolism. So I guess I'm like not that impressed by this, just because, you know, I'm not necessarily confident that even these oysters aren't more closely related potentially. Like, they're not siblings, but they could be cousins or something. So I don't really know if I want to like go down this rabbit hole. You could look at my 1 year old data a little bit differently and say, like, not consider parental PCO2 exposure and just say like, okay, these guys are related. Just look at like influence of genotype on expression, like leverage the fact that they're related or not related. So anyway, that is the end of the PCO2 comparison scenario.
Can I ask real quick how, when you did when you sampled the tissue from these mm-hmm. one-year-olds, mm-hmm. did you like bring them in from the field and kill them all in the lab, or yeah, like what were they experiencing right before you killed them?
Yeah. So I was out of town when this happened. Micah Horwath spearheaded the effort with an intern, and they they collected them in the field, put them on ice, brought them into Stephen's lab and processed them there. I asked that they do it all randomly. So like, you know, all these oysters are from the same location. So, and they sampled them at random basically. So they didn't do like one batch and then the next batch.
Yeah. So you're almost looking like, what is your like constituent differences in gene expression based on mm-hmm. what your parents experienced?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the other thing I could do is just focus on gene expression differences among these populations. So I have the three populations, and then in one of the populations, the Oyster Bay, I have a very inbred F2 cohort. So basically, Catherine, these were a group of oysters you gave me.
I can't believe they made it into something.
I know. Yeah, you said basically they're probably all siblings. This C1 population.
Cool.
So yeah, so basically like what I wanted to look at differential expression in the adults between populations, and I found a ton. So the plot on the left is just global expression, all my genes from all populations put into a PCA. The one on the right is all the DEGs. And this little figure down here is showing you how many DEGs between each comparison.
Is this kind of ignoring the OA treatment, or are you just mashing it all together?
I ignored it at this point. Yeah. Okay. I could
ignore it, but the data is there. So basically you combined it. Gotcha.
Okay. I combined it all just for this. Yeah. Yeah. I could
did you include parental PCO2 exposure as like you controlled for it in DSeq2 or?
I did not. All I did was just, okay. I ignored it at this point. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying I could make that a random variable, probably in DEC.
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which may or may not be appropriate or useful, but yeah.
Yeah, I could just compare the two populations separately, like depending on their exposure.
Yeah.
And then this is a heat map showing you all the DEGs, and I did pairwise comparisons between all the populations, and then this heat map is just showing you all those genes in one map. So there's a difference between, yeah, this is only exploratory. I know that this probably isn't the best way to merge all the data, but there's a lot of differences, which is cool. I think the most interesting thing is differential expression among population in the larvae. So again, this PCA here is just all of the genes color-coded by population. The one on the right is all the DEGs. And it's cool that the purple and the turquoise points all overlap, because those are the two, there's the F1 and F2s of the same population. So I found no differential expression between Oyster Bay F1s and their inbred offspring line. But then I found differences between other groups. Basically, like, I don't know, I haven't dug into the literature, but there's seemingly some major differences at this early larval stage between population. Now, we could get into the whole, like, are they at exactly the same stage? Because maybe they grow at slightly different rates question. But I did collect them. This is the day that they were released from their mother. So I at least controlled for that time point.
Well, this isn't too surprising, because you know these groups are genetically different, right?
This is gene expression, though.
Right. But I mean, that's going to change based on the genotype.
Yeah. I mean, these are all genes that were, collected across in all the samples.
Yeah.
I need to double check how I filtered that. But it's not like, you know, there's a bunch of genes that were not covered in one population. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just thinking like I need to see if there are any studies on larval physiology differences among genotypes. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's cool because, you know, just even like we assume they're genetically different. Obviously their like gene expression would be different, but I mean, this is linking genotype to phenotype, and yeah, and it's, you know, how much genetic variation means anything in terms of phenotype. And here we have like metrics of that. And then,
yeah, gene see expression what, being the phenotype.
Yeah. And if you see what those genes are, I think that that could be really informative. I do think that like day of capture may be something that also, I mean, yeah, I think if you looked at the PCA with day of release colored and you see a pattern, then I would recommend like using that as a covariate in DE-Seq 2, like binning, let's say like you were released in the first week, the second week, the third week, something like that, just in case.
Yeah, that
does matter. Because then you would imagine that that is also associated with population because like the populations, well, one, like I think in my work, they released at different times. And so you maybe saw that too.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I need to double check that it's not like all the Oyster Bay released before all the other ones. Yeah.
And it was colder then. And so the gene expression looked a little different then.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you, if they were spread out enough, or if you had a period where they were all releasing every other day or something, and that's captured here, then you could either just include that time period or control for it in DE-Seq 2. So you're like removing that.
Yep. That's a good idea. Yep. And then heat map with all those DEGs all in one. And then in my offspring, you know, this is kind of a weird comparison, but just if we want to look at differential expression among these populations, there's quite a few genes and that's it. So yeah, so my main thing is, do I want to focus on PCO2 exposure, or is it just more interesting to talk about population differences? I think the adult PCO2 exposure stuff is pretty solid. And then the larval stuff, you know, if I can,
stuff is
not interesting right now, but.
Well, it's interesting. Let me just trying to refresh my memory that you didn't see a difference at larval expression. You didn't see a parental effect, did you? Or you did?
No, I didn't. No.
You just have one DEG.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which in and itself is still interesting.
Yeah, but it's like the false discovery rate is, correction is.
But the fact that there was, you did not see a transcriptomic response in larvae with different parental expressions. Because you would kind of expect, based on prior data,
well,
there is,
I mean,
some kind of carryover effect. I mean, this would suggest that there's no signature of any carryover effect in the larval transcriptome.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is useful information, I think.
Mm-hmm.
At least at the environments that they were sampled at.
Right? Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. At the environment. Yeah.
They were not exposed to.
Right. There's no
quote unquote stressful environment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you consider the hatchery a stressful environment.
Right. But it's
it's a different kind of stress.
But doesn't negate the possibility that upon a second exposure, they would have a different physiology, but it's nothing this dramatically changed their inherent transcriptional patterns.
Yeah. And I did some like pilot sequencing. Catherine did it for me. You threw some of my samples in with your stuff. And I did see some differences in larval gene expression, but I think that could just be due to potentially genotype, the ones that I sent you. And also I think I included the parental temperature exposure, which I think resulted in larger larvae. So that's added information that you guys don't need to know, but I was kind of expecting there to be differences here, and I'm not seeing them. So
what if you were to combine the populations and look at a parental effect?
I did that, and I didn't, there were no DEGs. No. Yeah.
All right. And then out in the field, you saw a difference, but you also have evidence. You also believe that selection was a big player in there.
Yes. Yeah.
There's something. Yeah.
Which is interesting. I mean, like all these transgenerational carryover effect studies inherently have the issue that your breeding have capacity for selection to happen because you can't be sampling the same genotype across generations if you're doing transgenerational studies. So it's important for all these transgenerational studies to confirmed that they're not, that they're like the subsequent generations are not becoming just more and more related to each other.
So you've got a phenotype of, from parental exposure, right? From these?
I have, yeah, differing survival rates.
Different survival rates.
There, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Based on the parental exposure.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So that's suggestive that it's possibly a combination of selection and maybe some type of transgenerational plasticity. Is that a okay statement to make?
Yes, but I don't think we can pull apart those two.
The first variables. Thing that comes to mind is, is this interesting enough? Well, I don't know if you have any samples, is to really look at this, is literally look at selection and look genotype more individuals early and later and see is there any value of that?
Like expand the study to do more genotyping on more of the offspring that survived to the 1 year stage?
Well, yeah. I mean, if I don't, mm-hmm. I haven't digested it all, but that seems to be one interesting finding is you clearly see a transgenerational impact by looking at this figure right here. Like parental exposure does something to a phenotype, but you really can't tell the difference of what's going on. But even that, mm-hmm. I mean, just knowing, what does this mean? This means that could parental exposure influence selection in the next generation? And if that's basically what it's saying, right? If you assume selection's happening,
mm-hmm.
it's a phenomenon based on the parental exposure.
Yeah, but I mean, if we're basing, I don't know. I mean, this figure here showing you that more oysters survived if their parents were exposed to high PCO2. This is interesting, but I'd like to see this repeated.
Yeah.
Because the number of individuals is so small?
Yeah, I mean, I have four, N of four little packets of oysters in each group.
Okay.
In each treatment. So, the power is not.
Basically what you're getting at is you would not say it's worth an investment to look at underlying mechanisms because you're not totally comfortable with the phenotype data.
Had I seen had these oysters not been related and had I seen clear expression differences, I'd be like encouraged, like, oh, this might actually be real here, that their parental exposure influenced their physiology, but I just am now more dubious.
Go ahead, Catherine.
So like each, your survival of 1 year offspring, like how many total individuals did you start with? You said you just started with four and then
No. These are, each dot represents like a little baggie of oysters and each baggie had 10 oysters in it.
Okay.
And this was,
percent survival. Yeah. I mean, if do you have tissue samples from all of the oysters that survived?
I do, yeah. There's three other locations, Fidalgo Bay, where survival patterns were very similar to this. And then there were the Comish River Delta and Case Inlet, where there were no differences in survival.
And the bags of oysters were just random oysters from all the ones who grew up into bags and put out across all the sites. And then from one site, you did RNA-seq on four random oysters and found they're all half-sibs.
From these two populations, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like what's the chance of them all being a bunch of half-sibs?
Across all my oysters, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And it's especially because, the oysters that I have here are the ones that survived the outplant. And so...
Yeah.
The chance to increase, like if had I sequenced them before and then looked at their survival, I think that would have probably helped the situation because then I would have like a baseline. Like it would capture the expression patterns of oysters that died.
Yeah. Yeah, or you would at least be able to look at genotype, like actual selection, like Stephen is saying, yeah, if you had genotypes at the beginning and genotypes at the end, you know, what genes were selected on.
I have the ability to look at genotypes early on.
I have them in the larvae. So my pipeline finished with all these, with all these larval samples. So these larvae should include these guys.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those larvae grew up. I see. I mean, you could with like population from, I mean, that would actually be great. It would not include all of the selection that happened. I mean, it would include all the selection that happened before you planted them out. So, you know, things that happened in the hatchery and whatnot, but you could get like allele frequency from your larvae. And then if you sequence more of the ones that survived, allele frequency of those. And then you could say like, I mean, I would definitely look at the larvae and try to get some sense of relatedness.
Yeah.
Cause that might tell you like, okay, there's like one, there's two parents in this whole pool of larvae. Then you know that answer, but I'm not 100% sure how you do relatedness with pools.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what my results are, because I just ran everything through GATK, but
But what we're saying is if there's enough genetic diversity in the larvae, that would give a large enough platform for selection to really study. If there's not, then it's might not be worth looking at anymore. But if it is, then sequence, get more genotypes on the survivors and do allele frequency comparisons to actually see what's going on. And somehow in there, we're going to capture or try to have a better understanding of how parental exposure relates to selection.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So you can do the analysis with the larvae, I'm assuming, to look at genetic diversity and potential parents.
That's what I'm hoping to look at right when we get done. But
do you have any more samples from the survivors that we could genotype?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd have to confirm. I mean, I'd have to confirm how many samples I have, but I definitely have more.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do think you might have to use like a pooled sequencing approach. Yeah, like what we talked about, instead of GATK for the larval pools.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just because there's things that you have to take into account. And then that gives you, your allele frequency at a bunch of sites. Yeah. And it wouldn't maybe necessarily tell you relatedness, but would give you an idea of genetic diversity.
Yeah.
That I think you could compare to the offspring that you have, the 1 year offspring, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, if I only have like two families though in Debab Bay, for example, I'm guessing the allele frequency is going to be lower than in all the batches of larvae. But
well, that's just based on the four samples that you looked at, right? So you could have more diversity.
Yeah, I think Debab Bay though had a pretty low larval production, so
okay,
Fidalgo Bay would be the one that I would probably want to focus on, because there was much more reproduction happening there.
Yeah, that would be interesting, I would say, to be able to dig into that a little bit more, given because that's your hook here, is your cool experimental design, a parental exposure larvae out in the field and then sampling again. I mean, your second part is interesting, but your second part basically throws the experimental design out the window and just looks at which is interesting. Like Catherine said, I mean, it's giving you a phenotype. It's going from genotype to phenotype. Which hasn't been done too.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, I could then, like, I want to be able to show this stuff, the adult response stuff. So,
yeah. And the difference is, you basically, you need to split this into two papers.
Exactly. Yeah. And I have to choose one right now. Okay. All right, cool.
I think that first paper, like the adult gene expression stuff, would be simpler and cleaner to like focus on, if I were you. But
You mean just do the adult gene expression?
If you're talking about two separate papers, the paper being like adult gene expression, can you go back? The four genes you found were different between sites, like this stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'd add the larval non-result into the paper for gene expression.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a minor part.
Yeah, for sure.
But then what you're saying is don't go into the,
I guess, common garden. I guess should be included too. I was imagining if you found that you could look at selection, then saving this part of the result for a second paper might be better, but.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility, a way to do
but
it.
If you don't find that, then it should go in the first paper for sure, because it's still a cool result.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, I'm definitely gonna go and relook at the larval stuff, but including release date as a variable, and then go from there. And then I'll report back on what I find out with the larval genotyping stuff.
Yeah. And maybe start investigating the possibility of sending out more, people that have been out there a year.
Yeah. Okay.
See what you have, see what it would take to send those off, because if the cost is minimal, we just go ahead and send them out because we're gonna have to wait anyway. I don't even know how you genotype. Are these genotyping by QuantSeq?
Yes.
Okay. Did you make the QuantSeq or did somebody else?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a non-trivial library.
Yeah. Prep. Yeah. I wouldn't want to do that one again just to get, genotyping stuff.
Yeah.
You could develop a GT-Seq panel.
Could I? From this data? No, because Catherine's data. Yeah,
you could redo everything.
Redo everything.
But can you do, as a side note, can we pay somebody as a QuantSeq as a service? Does somebody do that?
UT definitely does. UCSD, one of the UC schools does.
Okay.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, the kit is pretty expensive too. Like, I'm sure there's a way to do it without the kit.
Yeah, but you were definitely not doing that.
TagSeq without the kit. Yeah. It's just, the cost, the cost of getting all those primers and stuff. It's sort of like what kind of investment you want to make up front versus the kit versus the troubleshooting. Yeah. Cool. Well, I actually have to go eat lunch, but those are cool results.
Yeah.
Thanks for feedback. Exciting.